Welcome to session number 171, Why Ordaining LDS Women Could Be Good for Men. We'd like to welcome you all out today, and I need to remind you to silence your cell phones and anything else that might make noise during this. I'm supposed to remind you that Sunstone earns a percentage of benchmark book sales at the symposium, so please visit the book vendor's room often. And we're going to be recording this session, so when we open it up to questions, please remember to come up to the mic so that we can hear on the tape also. And I'll introduce our speakers now, and then they will just go through in that order. Our first speaker is Mark Barnes. He leads the Male Ally Committee for Ordained Women. He's been an active supporter of Ordained Women since the launch event on April 6, 2013. Professionally, Mark is a trial attorney for the Office of Chief Counsel, IRS. He also teaches law, economics, and ethics at the University of Phoenix. Mark is the son of Elva M. Barnes, who is an active Utah feminist, humanitarian, and educator. He's the grandson of Beatrice Marchant, who was the founder of the Equal Rights Coalition of Utah, which advocated for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. Next will be Stephen Carter, who holds an MFA in fiction and a PhD in narrative studies. Since 2008, he has been the editor of Sunstone magazine. He became a documentary filmmaker while researching his dissertation in Shishmaref, Alaska. I should have asked how to say that. He is also an author and a stay-at-home dad. And then Michael J. Stevens is a management professor and department chair at Weber State University, where he teaches and conducts research in the areas of organizational behavior and leadership. He's also head of Sunstone's Education Committee. And our final speaker will be Jim Kelly. He's a career newspaper publisher who moved to Provo a dozen years ago to run the Daily Universe and taught in the religion department at BYU. He and his wife, Donna, a prosecutor with the Attorney General's office, have had their temple recommends restricted because they posted profiles on the Ordained Women website and continue to support their daughter, Kate Kelly, who was excommunicated for asking questions about gender inequality in the church.
All right. By way of advertising, I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the infamous six discussions that Ordained Women has been putting together that are now the six conversations, but there's going to be a seventh. And the seventh conversation is going to be one specifically geared towards male allies. And so that should be out, I anticipate, probably in 2 or 3 weeks. We'll be getting that out. But I wanted to kind of give you a preview of what we're working on as far as the seventh conversation goes. And before we can really get into the issue of why ordaining women is good for men and women alike, I thought we probably ought to focus a little bit on the problem. And so to look at that historically, I'm taking some stuff that will be in the Male Ally conversation that we're going to be putting out about the origins of privilege. My basic proposition is that privilege always comes out of violence, that violence is a source of privilege. Okay, so if you think about 200 years ago and how the world worked, the primary source of energy 200 years ago in the world was muscle, and that was both animal and human muscle. If you think about the speed limit at which information could travel at that point in time, it was the speed of a fast horse. Now that seems very weird to us because we're used to the age of the internet where things happen instantaneously. But just as an example, Andrew Jackson, who became famous and eventually president of the United States, the thing that made him famous was his triumph in the Battle of New Orleans 200 years ago. Well, the Battle of New Orleans happened 2 weeks after the war ended, and that was because information traveled so slowly. Muscle was the energy source, and therefore muscle had value economically. And when you think about the origins of privilege, I think that that's an important point to remember. So if you wanted to be better off 200 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, you had to control other people's bodies. That was your strategy to do it. And so that meant that institutions like slavery were ubiquitous throughout all societies. No societies didn't engage in slavery because that was a strategy to get to become better off. And the control of women's bodies was also important if you wanted to climb your way up in society and have a better life. Controlling women was an important strategy. And so slaves, we think of, you know, African slavery in the United States, controlling black men's and women's bodies, but women's bodies were controlled not just for the labor or the labor energy, but there were other benefits from it. One was you could control reproduction. And why was that important? Most of us plan to retire and we're going to have, Social Security and hopefully a pension and things like that. Well, if you go back a few hundred years, even a couple of hundred years, the strategy you had to pursue to be better off in your old age was to have lots of children, because those children, hopefully enough, would outlive you and they would be able to take care of you in your old age. So that was an important element. And to control reproduction, you have to control women. Also, the pleasure involved in sex was another thing that men would want to control. And so men, having on average larger body size than women, would use their muscle power to be able to control women. So when you think about privilege, remember that it's, you know, connected to violence. And in the same way, technology played a part in all this. So when you look at the origins of white privilege in Europe and America, where does white privilege come from? Well, that comes from a factor of Europeans being able to have superior technology for inflicting violence on other people. They could go over to Africa, use that technology in order to enslave Africans. And through that violence, we get the development of white privilege. Okay, now I want you to think even farther back, 10,000 years ago, before agriculture really hits its stride. And the people at that point in time would have been hunter-gatherer societies. And in a hunter-gatherer society, normally you're talking small bands, less than 150 people, and they're competing primarily through violence. So when archaeologists go back and look at skeletons from hunter-gatherers 10,000 years ago, what they find is a huge amount of blunt force trauma to those skeletons. And estimates have been made that probably about 25% of people died from murder in those societies. So very violent type situation. Most people wouldn't have lived past their 20s. And you really can't get much progress going if you constantly have to encounter violence. So you think about the conversion to agriculture and what would have had to happen. The problem with agriculture is you have to be stationary. So if you're engaging in planting crops or having, you know, some sheep and things like that, you can't be out there wandering around in the same way that you would if you were a hunter-gatherer society. But the problem is, if you're stationary, you're a target. You go to all that effort, you grow those crops, and somebody comes along, hits you over the head, and steals everything. So you, in order for agriculture to really come about, you have to develop a strategy that's going to solve the violence problem. And the violence problem was solved through government. So Max Weber, if you're familiar with him, has a definition that he came up with for government. He said a government is that entity that has a monopoly on the use of force within a particular geographic area. So the United States is a government because the United States government, more than anyone else, can control force within the territory of the United States. If you can have an entity that can control violence within a particular area, you can significantly reduce the amount of violence that's going on. That allows you to engage in agriculture, it allows you to do other things, and have some progress. So for the development of civilization, you have to have a solution to the violence problem. Now, those kind of governments, a group led by a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Douglas North, over the last few years, and done a lot of research in this area, and North and his group refer to that type of government that traditionally existed from the dawn of civilization in Egypt and Mesopotamia and places like that as a natural state or a limited access system. So this is a book that North and his group put out a couple of years ago called Violence and Social Order, and it's really interesting because it goes in and explains how these institutions develop. But in the early forms of a natural state or limited access system, basically you have a big man society. Somebody comes in that is bigger and badder than everyone else, kills off whoever challenges him, and rises to the top. So this is how you get the creation of the first real governments. So North's done that. Another person who wrote a similar book, but not nearly as detailed as North, Ryan Eisler, wrote The Chalice and the Blade. Short little book, but very interesting. I really recommend it. She calls that kind of society a dominator system. That's her term for it. And she contrasts it, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, with what she calls a partnership system, or North calls an open access system. So keep those terms in mind for a little bit later. So here's the problem if you're pharaoh or king or emperor, the person sitting at the top of one of these natural states, is that your state is made up of a coalition of elites. And the way you stay on top is to be able to keep those elites within your system while they all want to challenge you. Now, the first order of elites in a society like that are going to be violence specialists. They're the ones who can control what's happening within that territory. So let me give you an example of a system like that. I went to Japan on my mission, studied Japanese history a little bit. The first time that Japan was unified as a nation was in 1600 under a guy named Tokugawa Ieyasu. And Tokugawa Ieyasu was a warlord in a place called Edo, which today is Tokyo. And he had a problem. He's got lots of other warlords throughout the Japanese islands, all of which would love to be in his place and be on top. He's got to come up with a system of control for those people. So usually the top two tiers in these systems, one, the violence specialist, two, the religion specialist, because always an important part of keeping this kind of system together is there have to be myths that support the system. Those myths have to explain why the people at the top are in top and why they should stay on top. And it's much easier to control the system if you get people to agree to those myths and believe those myths, then they're not always challenging you. They might fear that challenging the system or the person at the top is, in essence, challenging God, and that will go very poorly for them. So those two groups are important to challenge or to control. So to do this, you have to have some sort of system of rewards and punishments. So if it's all punishment, people aren't going to stick with you. They're going to eventually get upset and they're going to challenge you. So you have to have some sort of reward system in place. You also have to have a viable threat, though, that if they do challenge you, they will think that they'll probably not succeed and maybe lose their life in the process. So Tokugawa Ieyasu, he had a great method. He would make all the warlords in Japan take their families and put them in his castle in Edo, and then the warlords would go out and spend several months in their own area. But if they ever challenged him, he had their family right there. He could just, you know, wipe them out. But he would also give them certain benefits and privileges to taxation and things like that. So there were rewards in place as well. Oftentimes in these systems, one of the primary rewards is access to women. So privilege in this type of system, that's a hallmark. And we see that in the Old Testament. King Solomon had hundreds of wives and concubines. That showed his status within the system. Mormonism has the same system, right? You go back into the 1830s, 1840s, and you start getting the development of access to women as being a hallmark of, one, a reward, but also a status symbol within the Mormon hierarchy. So you would know that the most powerful people with the greatest status were going to have the most access to women. That's very common. And it doesn't have to be polygamy or multiple wives. I mean, even in more modern days, powerful politicians have that have had lots of access to women, things like that. It's still part of the system today. Just one other thing before I forget. If you have women as a reward of status in a system, they can't be the equal to men in the system. So think of that when you're talking about male privilege within a system. Once you set women up as a reward in the system, they have to be subordinate. It just goes along with it. All right, so you got your system in place. You got your system of rewards and penalties all set up. It's now carrying on. Tokugawa Ieyasu, I said he was very successful in doing that. His system went for nearly 300 years, 1600 into the late 1800s before the Meiji Restoration. So a very successful system that he set up. But these systems become self-perpetuating. You got the myths in place, you got the rewards and penalties in place, offices, things like that, they self-perpetuate. But there's some aspects of human psychology that are very important to make them self-perpetuating. One is our propensity to conform. And an experiment back in 1951 that really highlighted this point was done by Solomon Ash. And if you look at this picture, it's a bunch of people sitting at a table. And I'm not sure how well you can see it, but in front of them are examples of two cards. So in this experiment, the first card would be held up, and then the second card would be held up, and then they would say, which line is the same length as the first card? And each participant would have to answer A, B, or C. So the whole thing was rigged. There was only one person sitting at that table who was the real subject of the experiment. Everybody else is a Confederate, and it's usually a guy that's pretty close to the last one to speak. So they start out asking, and everybody's given the right answer. Then they start giving wrong answers. And, like, they'll go through four people all giving the wrong answer and finally get to the guy who's the real subject and see how he answers. Does he give the truthful, accurate answer, or does he conform, even though his eyes clearly tell him the answer being given by everyone else is wrong, and give that answer? And it was really interesting. A lot of people would conform. A very high percentage of people would conform. They would not give the accurate answer. And some people reported that they even believed that the answer they were giving was the accurate answer. In other words, their perception would change, and they would see it as being the accurate answer. So this pressure we feel when everyone else around us says it's this way and we're not seeing it that way is a real pressure. That's a real psychological problem that human beings have. But it's also very useful for perpetuating the type of system that I've been talking about. Another experiment done in 1961 by Stanley Milgram, who's probably the most famous social scientist that ever lived, Milgram set up a system to test obedience. His question was, I've seen what happened in Germany. How did a modern nation like Germany just go insane? How could these people murder so many millions of people? Was it something about Germany, or could that happen with anyone? And so he set up this experiment where he had the actual subject's called the teacher. There's another person who's the learner, who's part of the experiment, in on the experiment. And then there's a third person who's dressed up like a scientist. And they tell the subject, the teacher, we're going to test the effect of electric shock on the learning process. So you're going to ask this guy questions. He gets a wrong answer. You have to give him a shock. And you keep increasing the voltage all the way up to 450 volts. And they wanted to see how far people would go. Now, the guy's not really getting shocked. The learner's not really getting shocked. He's in a separate room. It's all pre-recorded so that everybody has the same experiment. Their cries out, their complaints about my heart, and you know, all kinds of things going on. How far will they go? Most people went all the way to 450, and not just to 450, but they would do it twice more. So 450 was labeled XXX. You know, that went from low voltage, high voltage, very high, you know, dangerous, and then XXX. Most people went all the way to 450. And so Milgram concluded that this just shows how much we're wired to be obedient to authority. That part of human psychology also causes these systems to be self-perpetuating. Another aspect of these systems is transparency is damaging to them. Remember, you have to have this whole system of myths in place to explain why the people at the top are at the top. And people have to buy off on that. If they don't, it threatens the power structure. So you have to be very careful. You have to be very careful about what people have access to in the way of information. Just to sum this up, this creates vertical relationships, this type of a system. And vertical relationships mean that everybody's got their role. So women have their role, men have their role, elites have their role, everybody plays their role. It's a very artificial way to live. In contrast, systems that promote equality create horizontal relationships. And the advantage to that kind of system is people can be much more authentic. I don't have to play a role all the time. I can be who I am, and the other person that I meet can be who they are. And so I think this is one of the real advantages that we'll get from ordination of women, is that it creates authenticity within people. And we can be ourselves, and we can engage with each other as ourselves.
I have no slides, so you'll just have to look at me. I'm sorry. Okay. My thesis is that ordaining women could be good for the family, or for marriage. I hear that that Mormons are keen on that. So consider this. A boy and a girl meet while working in a student body presidency at BYU. They share common goals. They have compatible personalities. They each see each other displaying creativity and work ethic. They solve problems together. The dopamine flows when they're around each other. And eventually they say, hey, we make a great team. And they get married, never to see each other again. Oh, I didn't say that right. Never to work as a team again. Now, I know they put each other through school. They buy a house. They raise children. There is a lot of teamwork there. But let's think about what kind of teamwork traditional Mormon marriage actually entails. Usually, the couple divides up the work and gives each a role to perform in order to get the maximum amount of work done with the least amount of duplicated effort. And eventually they say, oh, I went back again. Often the male will be assigned the money making and the woman will be assigned the home duties. So in other words, Western and Mormon culture, a couple usually falls in love, gets married, and splits up. They rarely actually work together again. They're too busy taking care of the role requirements, as he was talking about, that turn marriage into an inefficient institution. However, I think that Mormonism has something very unique and even revolutionary to add to this structure. It's the notion that neither is the man without the woman, nor the woman without the man, combined with the idea that men and women can become gods and goddesses, priests and priestesses, and that they can't enter into the highest order of heaven without each other. So how about this? What if, instead of conceiving of marriage as a situation where a man and a woman show their devotion to each other by splitting up duties and inhabiting separate spheres for the rest of their lives, we think of it as an actual partnership where they work together? It's difficult to imagine because everything Mormon and Western culture teaches us about marriage militates against us. When does the romance novel end? At marriage. How often do we see a movie or read a book about marriage when the husband and wife are doing something together? How often do we see married couples working on a project together in real life? Instead, she supports her husband while he builds a career. He pays the bills so she can take care of the children. She supports him while he's the bishop. He hires babysitters so she can be at the PTA meeting. In almost all cases, the man and the woman split up duties and work in different spheres. So let's try a quick brain experiment. It's okay, you got plenty of pictures of me, man. I know, but you've had a lot of other pictures of me, so I'm okay. I can say that to him because I'm his brother, and he will forgive me, and I will buy you dinner tonight. So think about any general authority that you care to name. Who's his wife? And hey, while we're at it, pick any top-tier female leader in the LDS church. What's her husband's name? It goes both ways. Married couples don't work together in our culture, unless they're in Amway. I'm actually kind of serious about that. As I've heard, this lack of collaborative practice rears its head when an older couple goes on missions. So, because, you know, for the first time in their lives, they have to, in fact, work together every day, all day, and they usually have no idea how to do it. So in a way, we're not fulfilling the purpose of marriage, to make the woman and the man one. We treat marriage as a machine for raising children, forwarding careers, and fulfilling church callings. So I'd like to propose that a good way to integrate women into church leadership is to make all callings into dual callings for married couples. Now, I realize that that's not really a new idea, but it's one that I'm going to propose. I'm not talking about one spouse supporting the other in a calling. I'm talking about them double-teaming the calling. Think about what it would be like to live in a church where a husband and wife are encouraged to work together on a regular basis, entering into an intense relationship with each other where they collaborate on common goals, not in separate spheres and not with a division of labor, but together, mixing their creative juices, burning the midnight oil, experiencing the same tragedies and triumphs as they attempt to pull off the impossible. Running a primary, running a cannery, running a ward, running a temple, running a mission, running an apostleship, running a church. What if, all up and down the church's hierarchy, we saw married couples working together? It would put marriage front and center in everyone's mind. We would watch as couples learn to collaborate and carry out important callings. We would see how their differing strengths combine, how they become one. Now, I imagine that the first thing someone might say when presented with an idea of making callings into a married couples project is, well, who would take care of the kids while the couple is off being bishops? And it's a question that our culture currently doesn't have a very easy answer for, because child care is assigned to a gender. Certainly, if we put our minds to it, I think we could find solutions. Perhaps young men and young women could get some practice with child care. Perhaps time-intensive callings could be reserved for older couples that have fewer family responsibilities, or perhaps the children could have their own roles in these callings. Or maybe we could bring polygamy back. Oh, I thought that would get a laugh. Dang it. Okay, I'll just keep going. Pretend I didn't say that. Heaven knows we found plenty of ways to allow the father of a household to spend an extra 20 to 30 hours a week away from his family while being a bishop or a stake president on top of his career. It all just depends on what we value. So at the moment, it seems that Mormon culture values efficiency over relationship. The members of an admired Mormon couple are admired because of their ability to excel in their separate spheres, not for their ability to have an intense, creative, working relationship. We value what they produce through the division of labor: children raised, callings fulfilled, houses cleaned, scouts trips taken, careers launched, yards maintained, political offices attained. So hopefully, the opening of callings to couples would spill over, giving each member of the couple room to explore their potentials in other spheres. For example, through a series of circumstances, I happened to be the one who had a work-from-home job when my wife and I had our most recent child. So I was the one who got the experience raising a baby. And I'm here to tell you that it's one of the most life-altering experiences I have ever had. A completely new part of me was opened up. And at the same time, my wife was able to take advantage of an opportunity at work where she discovered that she has a particular genius for organizing people and projects. Had we stuck to our gender roles, I would never have grown so much as a nurturer, and she never would have grown so much as a leader. Watching each other develop has also made our marriage more interesting and satisfying. The couple calling structure might also change the way people choose their spouses. At the moment, Mormon and Western culture offer very little by way of a life narrative to married couples except the birth and development of children. When Mormons choose spouses, they have no precedent that urges them to marry someone they actually want to work with. They have no help in conceiving of their marriage as an evolving relationship. It's a series of births, church callings, and career moves with a mission tacked on at the end. Would you marry differently and with different expectations if you had grown up looking at pictures of apostle couples in front of the primary room? If you had watched the bishop couple work together on ward matters? If your mom and dad had gone through an intense 5-year period of a stake calling together? Would we start telling stories about marriages instead of stories about leaders? I personally think that such a structure would utterly alter the church's landscape for the better, though I'll also admit that it would take probably decades worth of really hard work to get it all together. We would develop dynamic couples that would accomplish great things together. We would raise children with head starts on how to work with others, and we'd be able to harness the hidden talents in both sexes. Admittedly, it would take a lot of work and a lot of collaboration to put this kind of structure together, and we'd be developing something pretty new, but that is sort of the way pioneers operate, right? We're pioneers. How much time do I have left? 5 minutes? If I read this one, it will make me cry. Should I do it?
Go for it.
All right, I'll read this one. This was published in Exponent 2 in their most recent issue, which you cannot buy because it was such an awesome issue that it's sold out. Sorry. Oh, you can buy it online? It just ran out here? Okay. It just ran out at the symposium. Buy it online. Okay. So this is a personal essay that I wrote for it. Over the past years, it's kind of an expansion on what I just said. Over the past five years, I've been altered. It's difficult to talk about this change, though. As a Mormon male, I'm used to talking about grand things, about the plan of salvation, the marvelous work and wonder, the stone cut from the mountain. When I thought about my life, I did so in the terms my patriarchal blessing gave me. I was among the elect. I would be a leader. I would be respected in my profession. But that language did not prepare me for what happened 5 years ago. Simply put, my wife and I conceived a child. Unsimply put, our lives had to change utterly. We had recently completed our PhD programs. My wife was teaching. Our two boys were in school, and I had just started working from home as an editor. How could we accommodate this new soul? How could we start the child-rearing process all over again? How could we continue to build our lives? After some discussion, we decided that I would juggle my job with taking care of the baby. I'd stay home with her, work while she napped, while the boys played with her, or while my wife was at home. Being the oldest of 9 children, as my mother can attest, I had the diaper changing, formula making, spit up cleaning skills I needed. Those years as a stay-at-home dad were like living in a snow globe. I inhabited a still, small, peaceful world. And in the middle of it, oh my gosh, it's already happened. I'm a boy and I'm not supposed to cry, right? Because it takes forever to get through your testimony if you cry. And in the middle of it, wriggling at my knees, lay a miracle. I'm not going to get through it, sorry. Consciousness gathering mote by mote in those dark blue eyes. I don't know. I can't tell. facial muscles building strength and nuance, voice chirping a bright new song. I discovered that a sleeping infant possesses an unparalleled beauty, and that the most important thing in the world is to soak that splendor into your soul before it evaporates. I also discovered that a conscious infant is an extraordinary world, illuminating itself gesture by gesture, sound by sound, look by look. This progression must also be witnessed. It must be remembered and told, committed to the deepest rooms of the heart. Do you want to see how the universe began? Do you want to see how it grew? Watch an infant, steep in the revelation of her being. However, the gravity of this child was voracious. It cut me off from the rest of the world. I had to build my life inside a tiny circle, and even that circumscribed existence was not my own. At any moment, the whole world could be shaken, the snow could fly, and I could become lost. Being a male, I didn't have access to many of the networks a stay-at-home mom usually has. The ladies in my ward benignly ignored me, trained by Mormon culture to avoid any kind of private contact with an adult male. So I wandered the neighborhood with my daughter, examining rocks, shouting down stormwater grates, collecting leaves, disturbing dogs. I spent months following this exquisite being while the world around me blurred into white noise. Despite the hours I put into my daughter on a daily basis, I worried that I was still somehow messing things up. How can I possibly be doing this right? Don't you have to be born for this job? Don't you need some sort of special power? Some kind of calling? Can a male even do this? I've heard the priesthood is reserved for men and motherhood for women. Was it motherhood that I experienced? I didn't seek it out. I wasn't trained for it. I never imagined fulfilling such a role. It was a calling in the truest sense of the word. It sought me, possessed me, broke me, and made me anew. May I testify? To the power of receiving an unsought calling. May I recommend that the gates be opened so that such a calling can transform the soul of anyone who is willing to accept it. No matter their gender, because sometimes the impossible opens its arms, a new creature finds you, an unknown hand knocks at your door. Okay, I'm done.
My journey to the place where I am now, what this panel is entitled, suggests, that of a male ally for the ordained women movement, is actually a place I never anticipated or set out to achieve or accomplish. Years ago when I started graduate school, I got into a management program that focused on the study of organizations, organizational behavior. And so that began a career 25 years ago at the tender age of 9. No? Nothing. Doogie House a reference? Anybody? And that began my career as essentially a student of organizations and things related to that. This followed on the heels of a short little stint as a commissioned officer in the United States Marine Corps. So if you want to talk about autocratic hierarchy, command and control organizations, I was trained at an early age from an outfit that has perfected it better than few others. After a short stint in the Marine Corps, both the Corps and I came to the conclusion it was probably not an ideal match, and we went our separate ways on good terms, but our separate ways nonetheless. As I was in graduate school, I began to focus intently on the kinds of skill sets, the kinds of structures, the kinds of underlying psychology and cultural variables that organizations needed to operate in a healthy, constructive, and functional way. And as I did this, I became more and more immersed in an understanding of the unintended consequences of organizational hierarchy. Now, in addition to the Marine Corps, I was also raised a good, loyal, faithful Mormon boy, so I understood the importance of obedience and organization and priesthood leadership and so on. I also attended seminary and institute and was introduced at one point to the idea that Joseph Smith had a remarkable way of reinventing the way we used and defined words, such as creation. In contrast to the prevailing Christian view of his day, where creation was a process whereby which God brought creation out of nothing, Joseph Smith taught us that the word create really has its roots in the concept of organizing. And so that when the Genesis story says that God created the heavens and the earth, what he wanted us to understand that to mean was that God organized the heavens and the earth out of the elements that already existed. In other words, God himself was the first great organizational behaviorist. Okay? Now that makes perfect sense, because when you bring organization out of chaos, what was God's conclusion of this? He pronounced it good. Well, what we forget is the sequel, which was that once you have organization, unless that's balanced by a countervailing force such as compassion and mercy, you end up with organization taking off and very quickly turning into intimidation, hierarchy, oppression, all for the sake of purity and structure. And so we find this phenomenon playing out as organizations have perpetuated over the history of human experience. And, of course, the last century or two, as we've gotten into the Industrial Revolution, organizations have become the ubiquitous identification for all of us. So these unintended consequences of organization, which quickly spill over into hierarchies of intimidation and control and coercion, ended up spinning off things like cultures of subordination, cultures of passive aggression, stifled creativity, covert obstructionism, losses of creative potential, artificial and stilted relationships, alienation of people from the work that they do and the communities to which they belong, followed many cases with resentment, perpetuation of victimization and abuse, not always intentional, willful abuse. Sometimes the abuse comes with a benign demeanor of the abuser, like the abusive parent who punishes children because they love you, children, and that it's going to hurt me more than it will you to administer this punishment. Self-reinforcing downward cycles of codependency by those who are in positions of power and authority over those who are dependent and subordinate. Perpetuation of an attitude of infantilization of adults well into adulthood rather than the healthy growth and maturation of individuation and autonomous emergence of authentic self-identity. So that's a rather, incredibly clear indictment of the unintended consequences of organizational hierarchy and autocratic structures that go unchecked. And so for my professional career then, I set about trying to find ways and mechanisms to undermine this and instead replace it with healthy partnerships, such as what Rhianne Eisler talks about in the book that Mark mentioned. So I'm starting to dig through this mountain of autocratic hierarchy that was clear to me was toxic, and I get about halfway through the mountain trying to undermine this, and there are all these women digging the other way. And I stopped and I said, well, this is it. What are you all doing here? I said, we're trying to undermine patriarchy. And I said, oh, well, I'm trying to undermine autocracy. And we compared notes, and lo and behold, came to the conclusion that we're setting about essentially the same journey. Now, of course, for me, I understood completely why women were on this path. What was perplexing to me is why men were not equally outraged by the same reality. This is the one thing that most men fail to grasp. Patriarchy, okay, the word archy means the rule or the governance of. So patriarchy is the rule or the governance by the fathers. Okay, patriarchy means that not just that men rule over women, but that some few men rule over everyone, including all the other men. Which means for all but 15 of our purported 15 million members, half of those, all the guys, are also subordinate. Now, for some reason, it doesn't register psychologically with men. And I suspect it has to do with the fact that, you know, even though you're a lowly male in the Mormon hierarchy, you at least have the hope of one day aspiring to be stake athletic director where you can exercise abuse and unrighteous dominion on all those high school jocks who took it out on you. Okay? So men have that one psychological release valve that allows them, for some inexplicable reason, to put up with this toxic organizational environment and culture. Now, when I start to lay out this kind of indictment, one of the responses I typically get from, you know, the faithful, true-believing members of the church is some pushback that I'm being harsh and critical of a wonderful organization that has done so much to bless the lives of so many. And I agree that there are many blessings that do flow from the typical traditional organizational structure of the church. But if you were to step back and evaluate in an objective, measurable way all of the fruits of Mormonism, here are a few that you can track down with any internet browser that gives you access to Google. So these are some of the fruits of Mormonism. Although I'm extrapolating a bit here, these are quite technically the fruits of Utah culture. So whether or not that equates the same thing to Mormonism, it's a surrogate measure. Utah has some of the highest rates of gay teen suicide in the United States. Utah has the highest prevalence of suicidal thoughts among adults. Utah has among the highest levels of personal bankruptcy in the United States. Utah leads the nation in affinity fraud. Utah leads the nation in online consumption of pornography. Utah leads the nation in diagnosed episodes of mental illness. Utah has rates of passive aggression in response to conflict that's at least 2.5 times the national average. Utah is in the top 5 for sexual assault and among the worst in gender pay disparity. So we want to talk about the fruits of our culture. It strikes me that these are the kinds of fruits that ought to grab the attention of men as well as women equally. As a result, one of the clearest, quickest ways of eviscerating this autocratic, hierarchical patriarchy that spins off what are, in my view, clinical diagnoses of cultural dysfunction would be to shake that culture at its core by ordaining women. Very quick, very simple, very direct way of realigning our cultural thinking. Now, of course, it's not going to do any good if the net effect of ordaining women is to turn women into a female version of a male autocrat. The corrective to patriarchy is not matriarchy. The corrective to patriarchy is partnership. Last but not least, if you look at the effects of ordaining women on men and the rest of the church, the one thing at both a personal level that I would echo is what Stephen just shared with us. The current emphasis on male hierarchy in the church does an extraordinary disservice to men and robs us of the vast potentiality for embracing our humanity. If you take a look, for example, at the Proclamation on the Family, I've just pulled some snippets here, a couple of paragraphs, but as you read the Proclamation on the Family, I don't know what necessarily jumps out at you, but this is what grabs my attention. Gender is an eternal, essential characteristic of individual mortality. It's eternal identity and purpose. In the second column, in this framework, what's the role of men? Preside and provide. That's it, the two P's. Preside and provide. Mothers are the ones who are primarily responsible for nurture. All right? Now, you hear what I would argue is clearly unsustainable by empirical evidence, which is that men are by their nature inclined to preside and patriarchy and provide and things of that nature. And women who are by their very nature inclined to empathy and compassion and nurturing and so on. The reason I call that a myth is that in point of fact, the data do not support that. For example, if you look at gender differences on measures of agreeableness, essentially non-existent. If you were to look at gender differences on emotional stability, essentially non-existent. If you were to look at differences in measures of empathy between men and women, essentially the difference is non-existent. So what that means is that we're perpetuating a myth that is limiting and profoundly debilitating towards women, but is also equally stultifying of men. I resent the fact that we live in a culture that tells me and Stephen Carter that our eternal purpose is to go out and make money and preside in an autocratic hierarchy. And it is not our right, indeed it's contrary to our eternal identity, to have the kind of experience raising a daughter and nurturing as Stephen Carter just suggested. And if we went about communicating a message to the men of the church that your experience of fatherhood, if you embrace it as a nurturer, can be profoundly transforming and can bring about an identity in you that is profoundly Christ-like, that's beyond your wildest imagination, if we held out the hope of that passion and that enthusiasm, we wouldn't have to play the charade of telling men that, oh, well, you don't engage in church because you're men. You're not religiously inclined because you're men. Of course not. Look at what you hold out for me as promise, that I get to work and make money and pay all the bills. And I come to church and you tell me that this is my highest aspiration. Whereas if you changed the narrative and you told me instead, come to church to learn how to embrace the humanity of your fatherhood, if that were the message, then we could get all this other mythological gender disparity out of the way, and we could simultaneously create a culture in the women for in our church where the women who have gifts to administer and to preside and provide, God bless them if that's their gift. I more than welcome them as the church, you know, as the ward financial clerk, rather than myself. I'd rather be out wandering the neighborhood with my daughter, like Stephen did. So, on that positive note, I'll go ahead and turn the time over to Jim.
My name's Jim Kelly. And I think we're going to turn a little bit from theoretical to how it is that I can share a little bit about my story. I used to introduce myself as a newspaper publisher, but in the last few years, now I have to spend a big part of that time explaining what newspapers are. So I shifted, and I started to introduce myself as the husband of Donna Kelly, who is a prosecutor with the Attorney General's office. And that did a little better. But the last, especially this summer, I simply introduced myself as Kate Kelly's dad, and everybody gets it. So I thought I'd just share with you a personal story about why it is that I think men will benefit from women being ordained in our church. Personally, the Kelly family will benefit because there will be, as Mark described, there will be far less blunt force trauma, at least in the Kelly household, which there has been a lot of this summer. I'm a convert to the church. I joined the church almost 40 years ago when I was at the University of Arizona. We had been married, and my wife was entering law school. Now, at the University of Utah, they're building a new building over here, and my guess is that today, when that new school opens and they have the first class coming in, it's pretty much going to be close to 50-50 in terms of men and women enrollment. I would be surprised if maybe there aren't even more women. But back in the day, there were three or four women entering Donna's first year in law school. So I would attend the spouses meeting as nearly the only guy in the whole group. And I never thought that it was odd. In fact, you know, it really never occurred to me until I moved to Utah 12 years ago that men and women aren't equal. Aren't equal in society. And it still shocks me. And this is a lesson that I only learned here, that men and women aren't equal in the church. I'm not a stranger to the church. I took to conversion. Donna and I gave our lives to the church. My wife spent 11 years teaching early morning seminary. You want to talk about a demanding call. Some of you, maybe from outside Utah, can relate more to early morning seminary. That's a huge commitment. I taught for a few years in between, but she taught far more than I did. What drew us to Utah is to come to save the world and the kingdom. Now, you may think that that's an odd thought, hanging your star on the Daily Universe at Brigham Young University. But that was the motivation. So we came. I taught in the religion department for 3 years, and it was a wonderful experience. I tell people that I met some of the most Christ-like people that I have ever met at BYU. And in the same breath, I tell them that I also met some of the people that are the least Christ-like I have ever come across in my life. So let's flash forward to maybe about a year and a half ago when Kate and Neil and many others started Ordain Women with the express purpose of being supportive of the church and trying to better the church. Don and I at the time said, we talked to Kate and Neil, and we said, listen, is this going to be critical of the church? Is the website that you're going to start going to lambaste church leaders and ridicule the church that we love? And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We have every intention of being polite and constructive and loving. And I'm here to tell you that that is exactly my observation. I don't pretend that it's objective, but it has been my observation that that has been the approach in our family. A year and a half ago, Donna went in for a temple recommend. At the time, the bishop said, well, I have some concerns about this, this posting that you're going to do, your profile. He said, but I'm not sure what I'm going to tell my granddaughter when she turns 12. Now, I'm not suggesting that he agreed with the posit of ordaining women, but he at least wasn't adversarial. There weren't any problems, her temple recommend was issued, and life went along. I also posted a profile, which is still up, and about a year later, which would have then put it early this spring, Donna went in for another conversation, and the conversation had changed a little bit. There's been a lot of talk in the church lately about tone. Well, boy, howdy, I will tell you that the tone of the leaders in the church regarding this conversation has changed drastically. But it still wasn't that bad. There was no overt threat. It wasn't a big deal. I subsequently went in and had a different conversation with the bishop, and the tone had changed a little more. The tone was now very uncomfortable. There are people in the ward and others that have suggested that I do something about you. And I thought, well, does that mean something would be, give me some money? I mean, what is it you're suggesting? I said, and let me preface this by saying that we're going to leave some time open for questions because I'm a journalist, and I think people always ought to ask questions. My immediate question was, who are they? Who's telling you that you, as bishop, as the common judge in Israel, need to do something about me? Well, I can't tell you. And I said, well, I would treat that comment the same way I treat anyone that I've ever interviewed, which is, that doesn't amount to a hill of beans. It doesn't mean anything. Unless you can identify an accuser, it's not real and it has no value. That was pretty close to the end of the conversation. Except to say that it was clearly a change of tone. Less than a month later than that, Kate received her, you know much of the story, so I won't go into the whole story, but as it relates to our family, here's what happened. Kate was summoned to a disciplinary council. Now, I'm no stranger to disciplinary councils myself. I lived in the church during a wonderful era in 1988 and 1989 when the entire church disciplinary system was changed. Removed were all the references to traditional court kinds of legalese that was understandably and properly received by church members as punitive, as punishment, as a terrible thing. That era changed, and it changed for some very wonderful reasons. The church finally took the stance that, you know what, when we excommunicate someone from this church, they go away, their spouse goes away, their family goes away, their kids go away, and if you can do the math on generations, pretty soon you've got a ward, prospectively the equivalent of a ward full of people that will have nothing to do with the church. That all changed in 1989. I was a bishop at the time, and we went from absolutely automatic excommunications for what today would never be grounds for excommunication. Serious sins, even. Infidelity. I won't go into all of them, but some were very serious sins. And the tone and the approach of the church was loving. And it was, if we divorce ourselves from this person, they will never come back, and we will never have an opportunity to lift them along with us back into the presence of the Savior. And so we had 30, 35, you know, the math's not right, probably 30 years of a movement toward drawing people closer to us as an organization. So Kate's notice of her disciplinary council comes. The following Sunday, I got a call. I think we got a call on, like, I don't know, it was probably Saturday night late. Got a call that the bishop would like to see Donna and I. The next day, we went into his office, and there's been a lot of talk in the church about conversations. This was not one of them. The door shut. We sat down. The bishop looked down at his desk and said that Donna was removed from her calling, and that both of us would have our temple privileges restricted, meaning that we couldn't attend the temple. Now, I want to make clear, he didn't ask us to turn in our recommends, but what was clear, that we could not attend the temple. We tried to have a conversation to find out what the reasoning was, who had given him marching orders to do that, where the instruction had come from. And we didn't make any headway at all, and that's the same position that we're in today. So then, 2 or 3 weeks later, Kate was excommunicated. Subsequent to that, I got up in fast and testimony meeting, and among other things, including bearing my testimony of the Savior and of the church, I said publicly and openly that my daughter had not sinned. That's the same stance that I hold today. And I am ever so grateful that Elder Uchtdorf, in April's conference, indicated publicly for the first time in a very, very long time that leaders in the church make mistakes. The church, and make no mistake about it, this isn't a rogue bishop in Virginia. This isn't a rogue bishop in Provo, Utah. there are mistakes being made, unfortunately, that harm women and men all over the world at the highest levels of administration. Now, that sounds like I'm overtly critical of the church. And in some respects, I am, for the mistakes that they have made, but I am still abundantly close to the Savior. One way that I describe it is, I understand the mechanics and the administrative nature of the church. And my resolve is, the administration of the church may be able to keep Kate and Donna and me out of a building, but it is not within the power or the purview of anyone in the church to keep us, to draw a line, to build a wall, to deny us access to Heavenly Father and living with Him through the atonement of the Savior Jesus Christ. We'd like to open it up to questions.
Steve, this is for you. I love your theory, your proposed suggestion for the church to make callings partnerships. I'm wondering how you would handle singles and same-gender couples.
Assign them to marriage.
That's a terrible idea. You know, actually, part of the quasi-inspiration that got me to think about couple callings was thinking about same-gender couples, because in those relationships, often people get to invent it, and they get to decide how they want to run things, what they feel called to do, what they decide to do. So I think same-gender bishoprics and stuff like that would work out just fine. They might even have a head start because they wouldn't have all the gender programming to overcome in their particular relationship. And the singles one is really interesting. It's almost as if the current church is actually set up for leadership callings to be singlehood callings. It seems like maybe we could almost keep that structure and have a particular structure for couple callings and singlehood callings, but that had never occurred to me before, that the church seems to be set up for singlehood callings, because we liberate the male from all the duties and put him singularly with other single men liberated from other duties to work together. Yeah, that is really strange. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Oh, yeah. Is that what happens to him? I didn't know that. Thank you.
This question is for you. You self-identified as a convert, but you were a convert at a very young age, and it's been a long time since then. What about being a convert gives you currently a different perspective than a lifelong member?
Sure. I think I have a different perspective from a number of background issues. I grew up in North Dakota, which you'll be happy to know was the last state in the Union that had a temple in the church. So when I came to the church, I was a graduate student. I didn't have any preconceived notions. I didn't grow up in going through young men and young women programs, that kind of thing, primary. Maybe there are some different perspectives. My mom graduated from college at age 17 and was teaching high school students that were about 6 months younger than her when she turned 18. It never occurred to me that men and women aren't equal. I think maybe the difference in perspective, you know, when we were considering coming to work for BYU, if I had a dollar for every one of my good, strong, faithful LDS pals in the Northwest that warned me about moving to Utah, we'd all go out to eat. Maybe I should have taken their advice. Certainly, I think that as anyone that is a convert, particularly once that you have become an adult, you have a different perspective because you know what you gave up and you know what you're gaining. I think that is fundamentally different. I'm not saying that people don't earn their own testimonies. Everyone does. But I do think it's a different perspective.
I want to thank you for your presentations and for the passion, because I actually think the system imprisons both men and women and hurt both. I like Gloria Steinem's comment that men live in cages. They may be gilded, but they're cages nevertheless. So I really appreciate that passion presentation in the institutional. I do have a question of you, because you surprised me about saying the church changed in 89-90, and then we went through this period. For a lot of us that have been very involved in the intellectual or historical community, it seems like the nature of discipline changed. That I know far more people. My wife and I counted up the other day, and we know of more than 50 people that have been called in the last 50 years for something they've written or said or something like that, starting with the September, or whatever, it's the, what do we call it? Yeah, the September 6th. That, so I was just surprised when you said, we reached out. I think we became kinder, in which I applaud, to people that, quote, sin. But we cracked down on the position of authority, power, and control. At least that's because I've just seen so many people called in, and many of them disciplined for things I'm not sure they would have previously been. So have you seen that, or has that been a surprise to you?
Well, lots of things have been a surprise to me. One of them is how faithful church members pronounce and use the word intellectual. It's a little bit like, I mean, here's how I would describe it. You have to forgive the journalist for a moment, but I would describe how folks that are in positions of power in the church use the word intellectual. It is as if they just ate some poison meat and they're barfing it up. That's the approach. And lest you think I should make that up, Mother's Day. You'll remember Mother's Day. That's an event in the church and in other churches where folks get together, they honor mothers, the primary gets up, they sing their song, another speaker speaks, and it's a pretty good time, especially when the kids sing, because they're not out there preaching. In our ward, in this order, we had the primary president get up over the pulpit and essentially bear her testimony, and the quote was, "I am so happy to be in the primary so that I can teach young boys and girls their proper gender roles." I didn't know that's what the primary was doing. I was educational, if nothing else. And, you know, I just started eating the poison meat right about then. That was followed by a mid-30s priesthood holder. I'm not sure exactly what he said, but he was very angry about it and had something to do with intellectuals. I don't think we even got to the mother's thing. And then it was 5 to the hour, and you all know this, it is an unwritten rule in the church that we're all sent to outer darkness if you end sacrament before 5 after. So a council in the stake presidency was summoned and gave a 7-minute oration without coming up for breath about how intellectuals are destroying the church. I thought it was Mother's Day.
I think it also highlights how important the church sees, because of its structure, the control of information and what people are exposed to. And intellectuals are the ones that are out there exposing people, digging up information. And, you know, part of what I was trying to get at is, in this type of system, information control is crucial to maintaining the system. And what I see ordaining women doing is transformative in a way. All by itself, it won't do anything. But ordained women always says, we're for two things. We're for ordaining women, but we're also for equality in the church. And it would be transformational to the structure of the church. It would have to change to a structure that no longer is this limited access, control information, hierarchy, roles, you know, elites on top, to a much more horizontal type of institution, where information in that type of situation is wonderful. Organizations with that type of structure feed off of information. And I think that if you look at the differences between ordained women and the church, that really highlights that difference. I mean, we organize through the internet, over Facebook. There is no hierarchy. There are no elites. It's, you know, peer-to-peer discussion, open information. We're all about getting it out there as fast as we can, as much as we can, which is exactly opposite of an organization that has the type of structure that the church has.
Yeah, well, I wanted to come back to your point about the shifts in the church disciplinary system. And I don't pretend to know all the ins and outs of how it goes. What I know is the effects. And 3 decades ago, I felt, and all of my counterparts felt, a really wonderful change. Now, it's ebbed and flowed. This isn't the first time that the church has cracked down on people that were raising women's issues. There are some in this room that went through some of those things. But I do know that there's a dampening effect now, this summer. The issue, the movement, ordained women, isn't about my daughter. She happens to be one of the victims of what we and many others, again, in a subjective view, are the victim of some really grouchy old white guys. Now, that's what my family calls me, so I feel like I'm part of the club. But not completely. That can change. But people have to be strong. And a lot of people in church have no spine. I know that may be easy for me to say. But when my bishop looked down at his desk and said, in 2 different occasions, in a little different wording, but the quote was almost the same. The first time, he said, well, you can have questions, but why do you have to raise them in public? And that is just like, I felt like I was on Mars. Of course you ask questions in public. That's what people do. That's what journalists do. That's what humans do. The second time, it wasn't a question. You can think what you want, but you may not bring this topic up in public. And I don't think my quote was exactly this, but it was pretty close. That is the silliest thing I've ever heard in my life. I am not going to do that. Do whatever you want. But my heart tells me that people know the right thing for themselves. What ordination of women can do. And I also should say at the outset, I should have said, I'm not sure I recognize any general authorities out in the audience. but I see some wearing dresses that may be. Hasten the day.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed all your comments. But Stephen, as much as I loved everything you said, and I was thinking, his idea, this actually would be super, super good for Mormon marriage. But I want to go back to her question of what about singles? People who reach the age of, 24, and haven't found a spouse.
Spinsterhood.
Yeah, people who get divorced. I mean, these people already feel terribly marginalized. And Janice Allred makes the argument that in Mormonism, you are not saved as an individual, you are saved as a role. She points to the proclamation on the family. And, I'm asking you to be a theologian a little bit. What would you really do? How would you be saved as a couple? And what would you really do about single people? Not those men who are liberated to go be single, but the poor people. What would you do about me, Stephen? Make the church a place I want to be. If everything revolves around marriage, then everything revolves around marriage. And it's still about a role, the role as a married person. Where does the individual fit into all of this? And that includes that's one of the things with what Mike is talking about, where it's in partnership. But does that mean fundamentally that we have to be saved with others, that we can never be saved as individuals? What about the individual in all of this?
Hey, Holly. That's a fantastic question. I actually think that you managed to drill past an assumption that was in my ideas. The thesis was that ordaining women could be good for marriage, so that's what I stuck with. But what you're doing is finding what I think is the really important part of what it is we're trying to get at here. And that is the purpose of life is to come into as intimate a contact with each other as possible, to become as family-esque as possible, to see each other straight, to see each other pure, to interact not with roles but with the soul that is standing before you. So one place where that can happen is in a marriage. It's a place where you could have more practice being present and aware of the soul of the other person. And so I think making callings into a place where for marriages would be one step in helping us to think about the other person, to help us actually connect, because we have the chance to connect with one person on an intense level, discovering all the aspects of them and being able to be enlarged that way. So hopefully that would be one more step in being able to have that relationship with Kate Kelly's dad and Michael J. Stevens. Because that's the goal, is to not treat each other like roles, but to be amazed at the souls of the people around us. Is that going in the right direction for you? Oh, sure, yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking of it as an exclusive club.
Well, and this may not be a conceptually gratifying answer, but from a pragmatic strategy, if you are presently driving your car through a ditch and somebody says, hey, let's at least drive along the side of the road rather than the ditch, and the goal is not, no, we want a healthy journey down a safe highway, okay, the edge of the road's better than the ditch, but it's still the edge of the road. So,
but I think your question is more important, is more constructive than my theory. I think you're going in more of the direction that we need to be thinking.
Kate Kelly's dad, that's funny.
I know his name's Chief.
So my question is, a lot of the argument we get against ordaining women from women primarily is that men in the church, if women were ordained, would give up because they would no longer be special and they would no longer have a place in the church where they felt in positions of authority and felt necessary, and so they would all leave and it would only be women in the church. And it sounds, at first it sounds really, you know, I think that's a juvenile question, but it's a very frequent one. It's a very serious one that a lot of people have. So as men in the church, can you respond to that question of how you would feel and how you think it would affect your peers?
Well, my first response is that even if you accept that there's an association, they have the causal arrow going backwards. It is not that men are leaving a church and therefore you have to reel them back in with this promise of this divine role of presiding and providing. It's just the opposite. You're failing to bring them in with any transformative vision for them as human beings, and instead what you're doing is driving them away because you're promising them that if they come and engage, they'll get to be in charge and pay the bills. And they don't find that compelling, so what do? They double down on the vision that, hey guys, come on over, you get to be in charge and pay the bills. So if there is an association, to whatever degree there is, I would argue that we've got the causal arrow backwards. Because we don't have a compelling vision for their transformative personhood as men, whatever association there might be is a causal arrow going the other way.
Yeah, and it's one of those arguments we hear all the time, and I've never put a lot of stock into it because it's just one of those so-so arguments that they tend to come up with. You know, we got to come up with something, so let's throw this one out there. It's never been my experience. That's, you know, never an issue where I've felt like, well, gee, I'm just this slug that, you know, won't do anything unless compelled by given, you know, because I'm given some sort of responsibility. And as my daughter put it the other day, it's just insane. What you're saying is that you're taking the very worst people and putting them at the top and in charge of the organization while you take the best people and put them out of any kind of control. So my daughter Tracy thought that was the most ridiculous thing she'd ever heard. And I agree with her.
There's a phrase for that. It's called survival of the least fit. Let me paint a picture for you of my ward. Utah County has the highest density of one religion anywhere in the country. We live north of BYU. When we moved into our ward, there were two homes that didn't have members in our ward boundaries. Oops, one of them was vacant because it's the house we moved into next to. That meant there was one home in our geographic ward boundary that there weren't members. The question was, did we have a ward mission leader? It was like a vacation. And I was it for a number of years. There are other thoughts, but the thought to that question is this. I have a lot more faith in men and in the church than that line of thinking. What if he didn't even wait till October in General Conference? If tomorrow President Monson held a news conference and said he's received a revelation and that women now hold the priesthood, I'm here to tell you that 99% of that line, that train of thinking, would disappear like smog over the Salt Lake Valley. We would like it to disappear over Salt Lake Valley.
Last question.
Thanks to both of you. I may have enough material here for at least two questions. I'll ask them quickly, blend them together if you wish. My first refers to, Jim, your comment about tone. How much does the bishop bear on the tone of the congregant that he's meeting with on any topic? Whether it's a bona fide sin and they're repentant of it, or any kind of pushback. Along with that, I want to tease apart what the church means by counsel, the bishop giving counsel. Is that a euphemism for something else?
Yeah. So two questions. One is tone, and I'm not sure I have the omnibus answer for that. Every single person in the church is unique and different. So is every bishop. Some of them are hardcore, and they're going to seem like Simon Legree. And some of them are going to seem like they're just really the most loving, patient, kind, time-giving people out there. My concern is that the concept of tone has been articulated specifically by the public relations department of the church in the last several months as somehow tone is a sin. Well, first of all, I'm planning on ordering a pretty big number of bumper stickers, and they're going to say, Jesus didn't have a PR department. What was the second question?
And just let me plug session 336 on Saturday, which is called Yes, All Women. Oh, it's at 11. And it's going to be about tone. You can hear all about tone.
When a bishop gives, quote, counsel, does he give room for the congregant to decline his counsel? To say, thank you, but no thank you. I'm going to take a path that I initially had in mind. I'll do it with kindness and love, but I'm going to move on my path.
The culture won't. Yeah, I think that's accurate. You know, and you also have to be a little bit wary when people say things like, I need to go pray about that. And I say wary because isn't that what we ought to do? You know, agency is what this church is built on. Not orders, not marching orders, not coercion. I think good bishops all over this planet recognize that counsel is a two-way street. It isn't barking orders. We're not in the military. We're all here, boy howdy, because we want to be. So I think good bishops, good parishioners, good members of the church recognize that every conversation in the church is a two-way street.